We are going to discuss herd mentality this hour, because examples of herd or crowd or sometimes even called mob mentality abound in the news. From protests that turn violent to political movements that can be ugly, even social media bullying, where people of a certain mind can gang up on someone who thinks differently, or when people might do something differently in a crowd that they would not have done if they were by themselves. We welcome your questions and your views about the influence of crowds on all of us. We'll talk about the negative and the positive aspects of the herd mentality with a guest who is an expert in crowd psychology. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 9 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Wednesday, October 12th. Have you or has someone you know been influenced by a crowd? Was it in a positive or a negative way? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Stephen Reicher, a professor of social psychology and former head of the School of Psychology at the University of St. Andrews. He is the co-author of several books, including Self and Nation, Categorization, Contestation and Mobilization, and The New Psychology of Leadership, Identity, Influence, and Power. Good morning. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hello.
So, define for us, what exactly do we mean when we say herd or group mentality?
Well, herd mentality is a term I don't like very much, because lots of these terms are much more, if you like, evaluations or rather condemnations rather than descriptions. We have this very strong sense in our culture that somehow individuals, when they're on their own, are rational, and when we get together in groups, we become irrational. So we use terms like mob to denote that, and herd, this is a sort of animalizing type of term, in order to get that view over. And I think those views are not only misinformed, that people don't become less rational in crowds, it's rather they act on the basis of different concerns and different values and different interests. And sometimes it's even counterproductive. And a lot of our work has been about showing that if you see people in crowds as negative, and if as a result you treat them in negative ways, if you treat people like animals, then you will produce the very things that you're afraid of. So as I say, these terms are not only, I think, misleading, they're also sometimes counterproductive.
And I'm glad we brought this up right in the very beginning, because I see it described all sorts of different ways. How do you describe how we are influenced by crowds?
Well, first of all, I tend to use just the word crowd as opposed to mob or herd or whatever. I think it's a more neutral term. The second requires us just to have a quick look at the history of crowd psychology and where it came from. You see, it was born just over 100 years ago, at the end of the 19th century, in France, where France was very unstable. It was racked by all sorts of movements attacking the system, and people were very scared of crowds. And many of the theorists looked at crowds from the outside, looked with fear, looked also with anger, with opposition, and argued that what happens in crowds is that people lose their identity, they become submerged, anonymous, as a result of which they lose their sense of identity, their capacity to judge, and they just go along with anything, even the most violent forms of behavior. Now, what our work and a lot of work has shown over the last 25 years or so is that it's not that we lose identity in the crowd and therefore lose judgment. It's rather that we shift our sense of identity from myself as an individual to myself as a group member. We act, if you like, in terms of shared social rather than individual identities. And as a result, we act in terms of the norms and the values of those groups. So what matters to us in a crowd is the well-being of the group. The things that are important to us are the values associated with the group. So there's a shift of the basis of our psychology, our sense of self, our control in the crowd. There isn't a loss. So things that we think go along with the group norms, we will go along with, and things that we don't, we won't. It's not that we do just anything, we get carried away. So, as I say, for me, in a crowd, we act in terms of social rather than individual identities, social rather than individual norms, and therefore there is a different basis to our rationality, not a loss of rationality in the crowd.
Yeah, so why do you think people believe crowd psychology has more negative effects than positive ones?
Well, I think, as I say, there's very much a politics of that. On the whole, it is true that the powerless gain their power through coming together in crowds, that it's in crowds that people challenge the status quo. They start challenge the interests of the status quo. And therefore, those who have power and those who have an interest in maintaining the social order look with both horror and disdain upon crowds. And crowd theory is one of the tools that is used to say that when people get together to challenge things, to say, well, actually, you're just being irrational. We don't need to take into account what you're saying. Just to use, I think, quite a powerful example, as many people quote time and again, Martin Luther King once said, the crowds are the language of the powerless. They're the voice of the powerless. Well, crowd theory is a way of silencing that voice, of ignoring those demands, of the elite continuing in their own merry way and ignoring the concerns of groups who feel excluded from society.
Yeah. And I guess I'm thinking of some very recent examples in the news when a protest, like a Black Lives Matter protest, turns violent. A lot of people look at that and say, you know, there is the negative aspects of crowd psychology.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm certainly not denying that appalling things happen in crowds. And I'm certainly not denying that violence happens in crowds. But my first point would be that when that happens, it's not so much due to a general crowd psychology, the notion that everybody in crowds becomes more prone to violence, because one can find very good examples of peaceful crowds or people being more peaceful in crowds than together. It has to do with the specific norms and values and histories of those groups. To talk about crowd psychology in general terms, it can be terribly misleading because it leads us to ignore the specificities of particular crowds. And the second point is, even when violence occurs, we need to distinguish between what you might call a social condemnation. It goes against our social notion of right and wrong, and an intellectual condemnation, arguing that that's just mindless behavior. What you normally find is that even when there is violence, the conditions under which violence occurs and the forms it takes and the targets it's aimed at reflect the understandings of the groups involved. So that even when you disagree with it, to call it mad or mindless or whatever actually loses you an ability to understand why it comes about and to do something about it.
So you are you think that crowds or groups can actually bring out the best in us, not the worst in us?
Well, what I'd argue is that in groups, we reveal the understandings of, that we share in common with other people within particular social categories. For historians, for instance, one of the great problems a historian has is how do we understand the perspective of the powerless groups in society who often don't leave records, they don't write histories, they don't write autobiographies, and so on and so forth. Many historians begin to say that if you want to understand the mentalities of those groups, their views of their world, their views of who is their friend and who is their enemy, then go and look at the crowd, because it's in the crowd that those collective understandings of society come out. Now, I'm not denying that many groups have actually deeply unpleasant views of society. They have views of society which are racist, which are violent, which are negative. But what I'm arguing is that is still meaningful. So I'm not making a moral statement that all crowds are good, all crowds are bad. I'm making, if you like, an analytic statement, which is to say that crowd behavior is always meaningful and tells us something about the world view of the groups who are involved. And just to dismiss it is to lose something which is very valuable in diagnosing the state of our society and what to do about it.
We are talking about crowd behavior, crowd psychology, how we are influenced by crowds or groups. And we're welcoming your thoughts and your questions and your experiences at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Stephen Reicher, a professor of social psychology, former head of the School of Psychology at the University of St. Andrews. We'll check news, and then we'll be back. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about crowd psychology during this hour. I had originally said we were talking about herd mentality or mob mentality, but our guest says that that really gives a negative connotation to how we are influenced by crowds, and he says that crowds can bring out the best in us, that they aren't necessarily a bad thing. And we are welcoming your thoughts and your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Stephen Reicher, a professor of social psychology and former head of the School of Psychology at the University of St. Andrews, and he is an expert on crowd psychology. You have been studying this topic for, a couple of decades now. Why are you so interested in it?
I've been doing it for a long, long time. The first crowd event that I studied, I was doing my PhD in Bristol, in the south of England, when we had the first of our urban riots, which was, I still remember, April the 2nd, 1980. So that tells you how old I am. Mm-hmm. I've been doing it for a long time. Crowds interest me for a whole series of reasons. First of all, I think we underappreciate how important crowds are as a social phenomenon in actually not only reflecting the nature of our society and the relations between groups in our society, but also creating our society. So if, for instance, you want to understand the relationship between black people and white people, or whatever, a crowd encapsulates that reality. It's like a snapshot of how people see relations between groups. But crowds, of course, most social changes have happened because of crowds. I mean, if you want to ask why you have a black president, why you might have a woman president, you can't answer that question without the civil rights movement, without the marches, without the women's movement, and so on. But crowds can also be used in the other way. Crowds can be used to consolidate power. Crowds can be used to stop social change. So if we look, for instance, at the moment in Turkey, where there's just been a coup, crowds are being used to consolidate the power of the president and to stop opposition. So crowds are fascinating, but also central social phenomena. But they also, and this is what interests me as a social psychologist, tell you something really important about the nature of human psychology and how the individual relates to the society, how the individual is formed by society, and how individuals can change society. So I love crowds. I've been doing it for 35 years, and if I have another 35 years left, I'll continue trying to get to the bottom of them.
Well, since you brought up politics in the U.S. and Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, what do crowds say about the rise of Donald Trump?
Well, one of the points I was making earlier is that crowds are not just these irrational explosions. They tell you something about the world view of the groups involved. And I would say that if you want to understand the politics of Donald Trump, and if you want to understand an America with Donald Trump as president would be like, then look at his rallies. And I think they're terribly informative, because Donald Trump's narrative is that America is a country in decline, that it's beset by enemies without, like Mexicans coming into the country, and it's betrayed by an elite within, by liberals, by the political establishment, by you, by the media as well. And that is very much, if you like, performed in the rallies, which are like a bit of theatre. So in Trump rallies, about an hour before Trump arrives, security guards will come and stand with their backs to the stage and look at the crowd, scanning for people who might be oppositional, who might not be enthusiastic enough. And that sets up a very clear sense of threat. If you're standing in that crowd, why would those people be there unless there were dangerous people amongst you? So you begin to be suspicious and look for people. And then when the rallies begin, quite often he will refer to the media as the enemy who is in that room, and he will get the crowd to bay at that enemy, and he will perform, if you like, a symbolic victory over that establishment, because in this particular rally, the people at the rally gain the upper hand. They can expel the protester, they can dominate the media, and so on. So if you like, the crowd itself is a piece of theatre. It's a performance which enacts the view of society and the sort of society that people would like to create. It's terribly informative. So I always say to people, if you want to understand a society that you don't know, far more than anything else, go and look at some sort of collective event, and it will tell you a huge amount about the world that you're in.
Yeah. What's your reaction to, your response to Hillary Clinton calling Donald Trump's supporters a basket of deplorables?
I think she herself would say that was not wise. You see, clearly, the dominant construction, the sense of groups to which Trump appeals, is the notion of ordinary people betrayed by a political elite. A sense that they ignore us, they're not of us, they're not interested in us. And that's in part why the more that he breaks the rules, the more he actually, in some senses, exemplifies that. He just doesn't say it. He doesn't just say it. He does it. So his lack of civility, his crudity, and so on, says, "Yeah, I might be a bit crude. I might break the rules, but I'm like you. You know, I'm like just an ordinary person." And of course, that statement by Hillary Clinton plays into that construction of an elite who sneer at ordinary people. It was a grave mistake. Now, one of the effects of the recent tape and its effects, I think, are to undermine Trump for precisely the same reason. You see, it's not just about gender. I mean, it's not just that he shows a quite appalling contempt for women. It's also that it plays into the fear that we all have, that those who pretend to be on our side are actually sneering at us. So very much in that tape, you get a sense of the guy who considers himself above ordinary people. He's a star, so he can do what he likes to ordinary people. It's not just that they're women, it's that they're ordinary women. So I think Trump's action, and in his case, it's not just a statement, it seems to be a much more powerful revelation, undermines him in exactly the same way that Clinton's statement undermines her, but it's even more catastrophic for him because his whole standing depends not on competence, not on expertise, not on knowledge, but being of one of us, one of the ordinary people against the elite. He's now shown himself to be one of the sneering elite who look down on ordinary people.
We are talking about the psychology of crowds with our guest, Stephen Reicher, a professor of social psychology, former head of the School of Psychology at the University of St. Andrews. And we're welcoming your thoughts and your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We have some callers waiting, so let's go to John in Boaz. Hi, John.
Good morning. I wanted to ask your guest a question. What could the people have done in Germany in 1933 to avoid the exploitation of the crowd with the fantastic rallies that the political people, which eventually ruined the German government?
So the rise of Hitler you're talking about, John.
Yes.
Yeah. So how does the crowd psychology play into that?
Well, thanks, John. I think that's a tremendously important question. Personally, it's a question that in many ways brought me into psychology because my family is Jewish and they suffered from the consequence of those crowds. Now, for me, one of the most powerful things about those crowds is they don't only affect the people in them, they affect everybody around them who looks at them and sees that level of conformity and thinks that everybody supports Adolf Hitler. So that even if they themselves disapprove, they begin to feel, well, perhaps I'm alone, or perhaps I'm going against the tide, and I'm violating the norms, and they don't speak out. And there's some really interesting work about the way in which just ordinary people responded when the Nazis began to move against minorities. All sorts of people. I mean, mainly Jewish people, but also, gypsies, Jehovah's Witnesses, and so on. And people watched as people were thrown out of their houses, and they watched as they were isolated in their schools, and they did nothing. Now, those people might have thought, well, we're just watching. We're not part and parcel of this. But by doing nothing, they send a message to each other which says, this is going on and nobody disapproves. And so you begin to get a sense in the society as a whole that, well, whatever I think, everybody else is for that. And often dictators work not by trying to change people's own views, but by trying to change their views of what other people think. So whatever they think, again, they don't challenge things. And that, what that says is, first of all, there is a hugely important role of the bystander. Even if it's simple, and even if it's passive, and even if it's just saying, no, I disagree with that, that begins to undermine the consensus around the dictator, his ability to seem to speak in terms of the consensus, and makes it easier for people to get together to say no and to oppose him. So the way in which you create not only individual attitudes, but a sense of shared social norms, and the way in which you challenge oppressive, racist, destructive social norms, I think is one of the key messages that comes out of the role of Hitler. You see, a while back, we visited the U.S. Holocaust Museum in Washington, and they used to survey people, and they used to ask them, after they'd been around the exhibit, what have you learned from that? And most people said, well, we've learned that the Nazis were appalling. Now, that's great. Of course it's great, and of course the Nazis were appalling. But in some ways, it doesn't get you that far, because it doesn't get you to question yourself. And what they're now trying to do with their new exhibit set called They Were Neighbors, which is about the ordinary people who stood by, is to get ordinary people, not the racists, not the pro-Nazis, to ask themselves the questions, what about our small actions? What about our responsibility? What about what we do and how that plays into the process? So don't just look at them. Don't just look at the racists. Ask ourselves the question, what do we do to say that doesn't represent us? I think that's a key message.
Yeah. Well, and I should say that one of the articles that we saw that prompted our discussion today was, it was an opinion piece about how people should separate themselves from herd mentality. And that, I think, is the message of that, even though herd mentality is the phrase used there, which I know you don't agree with. But I think it was, don't agree with the crowd just because... Don't agree with the crowd if the crowd has views you think are wrong.
Oh, absolutely, I agree with that. But the important thing is we've got to separate out two things. It's not saying don't agree with the crowd. It's saying don't agree with things that you don't approve of. Don't be silent in the face of things that you disapprove of. Now, the danger is that we are told that crowds are always in the wrong, crowds are always bad, and we should always separate ourselves out from the crowd. And I think that is a bad message, and it's a bad message because while some crowds are appalling, many of the good things in our society come out of of crowds. The American Revolution, of course, comes out of crowds. All sorts of forms of equality comes out of crowds. And if people are enjoined always to stand aside from the crowd, we would never have come together to achieve all those things in our society. So it's not the crowd per se, and it's not as if there's some general animalistic herd mentality in all crowds you should always separate yourself from. It's that there are different crowds with different social norms, some of which are progressive, some of which aren't, and you should always be absolutely explicit that when you need to join in, you join in. And when you disapprove, you don't stay silent, you disapprove.
Let's take another call from Doug in Eau Claire. Hello, Doug.
Hi. I was wondering, certain things, you know, that go on at these rallies. In some instances, Donald Trump has so many people at his rallies that they can't even contain them all in the venue that they've provided because there's just so many people. And in a lot of instances with Hillary Clinton's rallies, they're embarrassed to even stand back to show that there's so very few people there. I mean, what do you think that means in today's society?
Well, I should first of all say that you have the advantage over me. I would love to come over to the States and look at the rallies in more detail. And one of the things I do generally say when asked about very specific things is one's got to be careful because crowds are different and crowds very much depend upon context. And asking a psychologist to analyze a specific crowd rather than the general processes which work in crowds is a bit like asking a doctor to diagnose a patient as opposed to talk about a disease in general, to diagnose a patient without seeing them. So I'm slightly reticent because I haven't been there. But the point that I think you make is a very powerful point, which is, again, this point about creating norms, creating a sense amongst us of what other people think. And the size of a crowd in that regard can be terribly important. And it's quite clear from the little that I have seen that Donald Trump very much makes a big issue of the size of his crowds in order to say that, you know, people in general agree with me. Now, there's a lot of research which shows that whether people express an opinion or not is not only a matter of whether they hold it strongly or not, it's what they think that other people think. If we think we're running against the tide, on the whole, we become slightly silent. We don't oppose things, and therefore that movement goes on unopposed. So the use of numbers in Trump rallies is very important in terms of setting up norms and expectations about behavior. And certainly it's something which I think Donald Trump himself is extremely aware of.
How do you explain a split in a crowd like we are seeing in the Republican Party in the United States, where just yesterday, our House Speaker, who happens to be from Wisconsin, Paul Ryan, is saying, we're not supporting Trump anymore. And Trump says, good, the shackles are off. I don't need you anyway, kind of a thing. And now we have this big split.
Yep. No, I've been following that closely, and I was very interested to be talking to people in Wisconsin, given that that Ryan does come from Wisconsin. I think there's a difference between, you know, people splitting politically and splits in crowds. You see, one of the points that I've made is that, first of all, I think one distinction we need to make. I probably should have done this earlier, but let me make it. It comes back to what we mean by a crowd. And we tend to use the word crowd in two different ways. We use it in a physical sense, or just a sense that people are gathered together in one place. And we use it in a psychological sense, a sense of people who are gathered with a sense that they form part of a common group, a sense of we-ness amongst them. And there are huge differences between those two types of crowds. The example I always use, very British example, I apologize for that, is you get on a commuter train, right, and you're crowded, it's a crowd of people, but you feel psychologically completely separate from them. You don't want to look at them, you don't want to talk to them, you certainly don't want to be touched by them. And then the train stops, it breaks down, and after about half an hour, there's some lame excuse from the train company, and then things change, because now you start seeing yourself as part of a group. We commuters, you know, misused again by the train
company. Yeah, and I'm going to jump in because we do have a news break, but we'll pick up on this point after the news, and we'll welcome more of your thoughts about the psychology of crowds. This hour, we are talking about crowd psychology with a guest who is an expert in crowd psychology, Stephen Reicher, professor of social psychology, former head of the School of Psychology at the University of St. Andrews. And we're welcoming your thoughts and your questions about crowds. Do you think that crowds are largely negative or positive? We started off the conversation talking about the negative aspects of what is sometimes called a crowd or herd mentality. Well, our guest says that crowds can certainly bring out the best in people as well. There are many positive aspects about crowds. And we're welcoming your thoughts, your questions, your examples, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. And we were talking about the definition of crowds when we had to break for news, Professor Reicher, and I thought that was a good example, actually, that you were mentioning when we're on a train or a bus, for that matter, we don't necessarily feel that we're a part of a crowd at that moment. We're just with a bunch of other commuters, and we don't want anything to do with them necessarily. But if something might bring us together, like the bus or train breaking down, that then it's all of us are, you know, in this together, kind of a thing.
Yeah. And everything changes. You know, people start talking to each other, smiling at each other. You know, in Britain, people even start sharing sandwiches, and for British people, that's pretty extreme. So my point is there's a difference between a psychological group and a physical group. And in the same physical crowd, you could have no psychological crowds, as in people going shopping, or you could have multiple psychological crowds. So at a rally, typically, you will have all sorts of different people. You might have more extreme or less extreme people, people with slightly different politics. Now, sometimes what's going on, say, on stage encompasses all of them, and they come together, and they have a sense of commonality. But when it comes to specifics, it might then come to the specific tactics you're using, and that might split people in the crowd, and the crowd becomes divided. So the skill of a speaker often is to speak in ways which create one single psychological crowd rather than splitting into the subgroups, which then leads to antagonism and undermines you. We all know, that a house divided cannot stand.
Yeah. Well, this came up because I was asking about the split in the Republican Party in the United States, based on Donald Trump's remarks on that audio tape and being uninvited to a rally in Wisconsin by House Speaker Paul Ryan. The two are publicly, in a feud. Is the Republican Party a crowd?
It's certainly a group. It's other things besides, but it's certainly a group, but it's also a coalition, of course. I mean, one of the things that we know is that political parties tend to be coalitions of different groups, and electoral success depends upon bringing together different elements of that coalition. So, you know, the great success of Ronald Reagan was to be able to appeal to different types of conservatives, social conservatives, economic conservatives, and so on. And what is disastrous is where that coalition splits aside, and what was a single group splits into different types of groups, and that's what's happening at the moment, clearly, and that's why it's so damaging to the prospects of the Republicans.
Let's go to Jeff in Madison, who's been waiting. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning. Without delving actually into partisan politics, the crowd mentalities that we're sort of discussing, or, well, I'm listening to, what would be the take on people actually on the individual partisanship and group partisanship as a response, as a direct response, specific partisanship as a response to a specific partisan movement, such as the rise of the left wing over the last several years, actually not necessarily the current administration, but the last couple of administrations, and how that's resulted in the new quasi-nationalistic true right-wing movements that we're starting to see now. I mean, would you really kind of call this a natural predator of that almost communistic left-wing move?
All right, Jeff, I know you don't want to get it, but I want to be clear so we understand what you're saying.
I'll retract that last part of it, I guess.
So you're saying that, we had Barack Obama elected, and then we also saw a Tea Party, a very conservative right-wing faction of the Republican Party, to some extent, go rise. I think that's what Jeff is saying.
If I could take what I think is the general point, and I think is a really important point, which is that groups always define themselves against others. And therefore, the nature of the other will determine how you see yourself. We do this in our experiments all the time. If we want to change identities, right? If I want to get somebody to think of themselves, say, as British, I will say, we're doing a study where we're looking at how people behave in different countries in Scandinavia, in the US, and in Britain. And they define themselves as Britain against those other countries. If I want to get people to define themselves in a narrower identity, say as Scottish, as opposed to British, I say we're doing studies looking at how people behave in Wales and England and Scotland. So the way you define the other affects how we define ourselves. And politically, one of the ways in which you can try and bring people together, precisely trying to get larger and more coherent and therefore more powerful in-groups, is to define, you know, an other. So clearly, politically, it is powerful for the, if you want to get a right-wing coalition, to define it against a large and dangerous left to whom we are, whatever the differences between us, we have something in common. And also, the more that you can portray that as threatening and dangerous and alien to our values, the more you're likely to mobilize people. So whether we think there is a communist threat and a dangerous left or not, the ability to invoke such a thing, to describe ourselves as under threat from it, is a powerful tool in order to bring people together. Now, that can be something rather dangerous, because it does mean that using threat and invoking danger can be a powerful political tool, and if misused, of course, it can undermine the greater coherence of the American people, undermine civility and lead to domestic conflict. So it's a powerful political tool, but like many powerful political tools, it's also a very dangerous political tool.
Next we go to Gay in Kenosha. Hello, Gay.
Hi. I was just wondering what your thoughts were on the NADP, the North Dakota Access Pipeline, that's going on in Stone Camp, South Dakota. There is a large crowd that's been there for a couple months, and it's a very peaceful crowd. And what worries me is that people are being arrested, and I'm wondering, is there, like, something you do right with your research that crowds can do right that, you know, prevents them from, you know, having a negative response?
That's a really important question, so thank you for that. A lot of the work that we have tried to do is to work not just with the crowd, but also to work with the police so that we can have non-conflictual crowds, non-conflictual collective behavior. Because it seems to me that one of the fundamental aspects of any democracy is the right of people to dissent and the right of people to voice their dissent in a way that is safe and that is peaceful. If it becomes dangerous, it doesn't only become dangerous for the society, it becomes narrow. I mean, so on the whole, if it's dangerous, then women and children are less likely to come along. The street fighting men are left alone, and so you get an escalation of violence. So a lot of our work has been about non-conflictual public order policing. Now, this comes back to a point that I've made a couple of times, but at the beginning, beginning and throughout, that if you see crowds as dangerous, then that can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. And particularly if you add to that the point that crowds on the whole, a physical crowd, includes many different elements, then the danger of traditional policing is you see a few conflictual groupings within the physical crowd, a few people who want to make trouble. As a result of that, you clamp down on everybody. You, in Britain, it's often referred to as kettling. You surround people, you don't allow them to go anywhere, you don't allow them to go home, you don't allow them to protest, or you use tactics which are indiscriminate against the crowd as a whole to try and get them to disperse. Now, the problem about that is that you don't only catch the groupings who want to cause trouble, you catch groupings who initially didn't want to cause trouble. What's more, you set yourself up as the enemy, and therefore the voice of those who are radical and oppositional, who say the police are your enemy, have a go at them, becomes more credible. Ironically, your fear of those groupings, those radical and conflictual groupings within the crowd, give them more influence, more purchase, and, you know, makes them more successful in creating violence. So I think it's very important in public order policing, first of all, to understand the crowd and crowd psychology and the different groupings within the crowd. Secondly, for public order policing, to start from the question, not how can we stop these people because they're dangerous, but how can we, if they, you know, for the majority who have legitimate aims, how can we help them and how can we facilitate them? And if we have to intervene, we don't intervene in discriminate ways, but in targeted ways. And we've tried to apply that, myself and one of my colleagues, Clifford Stott, have tried to apply that in Britain and in Europe, and it proves extremely successful. In fact, one of the things that happens is that those people who don't want violence in the first place actually help the police in policing those who are violent. So you can see traditional repressive policing escalating and what we call facilitatory policing actually de-escalating. And I think it's very important to think of violence not just as being in the crowd, but as an interaction between the crowd and other groups, notably the police, and to inquire how we can get both to act in ways that de-escalate rather than escalate violence.
Well, that's an important point, and we'll have to end it there. Thank you so very much for being with us. Stephen Reicher, professor of social psychology, former head of the School of Psychology at the University of St. Andrews. Thanks to Naeja Ellison and to Brianne Shasso for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. The Big Question is next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.